Blog Talk Radio.
This is Cindy S. Solomon coming to you live today on March 12th from the San Francisco Bay Area with the Global Product Management Talk. I'm delighted to have with us today Kelly Abbott, who is the president and co-founder of 3ONES, and we are discussing how to develop products that customers love by creating passionate users. Also with us today is the famous Nick Koster of BrainMates in Australia. The Global Product Management Talk is a weekly podcast. We raise the bar for what is possible to accomplish in a real-time open platform event by encouraging participants to expand their knowledge base with each event, utilize new products in real-time as we introduce and beta test various products for participating, enable participants to showcase their knowledge and share resources, and crowdsource educational content for product people to stay apprised of new developments, thinkers, and events in the practice of managing products from inception to market and innovation. We are a live broadcast currently with a Twitter back channel. Please join us on Twitter using the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK to follow the discussion. Also, in between our weekly chats on Twitter, which are turned into podcasts for you to listen to on your mobile devices through iTunes, and we recently got syndicated on the Stitcher mobile app, so you can find us there. You can find us in Google Play, and you can find us on the Blog Talk Radio app. You can also go to Blog Talk Radio online and look for Product Management Talk to listen live and to listen to our 37 past podcasts. We have added Startup Talk Radio to the lineup, and we recently spoke with Dan, who is the CIO of Blue Seed Project, and they are creating a Googleplex off the coast of Silicon Valley to allow international entrepreneurs to come and create startups without visa considerations. So please check that out, as well as our Product Camp Radio and our Tools of the Trade Radio. Welcome Robert Eden, who I see is joining us in the Tweet Chat room. We're at tweetchat.com/room/prodmanagementtalk. And welcome Michael Hahn, who is helping us out as a community manager today. So love of a product goes beyond a good usability and an extensive feature list. It requires a deeper connection with the needs of the customer. Borrowing on Kathy Sierra's work in creating excellent customers, how do companies develop products for passionate users? When you create an ecosystem and a community around a product, how can a company benefit from users helping each other become better? As a product manager, how do you create passionate users? How do you move them up the ladder of participation from awareness to conversion to evangelist? And how do you measure the passion of your users? Also, by the way, we are brought to you today by the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, that provides webinars and trainings and certification. Please check out their upcoming webinar on becoming an industry standard certified product manager. So Kelly Abbott, who is our speaker today, is the president and co-founder of 3ONES. Kelly Abbott brings over 10 years of leadership experience in developing applications for the web, mobile, and social networking destinations. Most recently, Kelly founded 3ONES, which is a product development company working with major media, including Oprah.com and CWTV.com, and also startups to augment their staff in mobile and social media development. Previously, Kelly was Vice President of Product Development for People Media, managing 32 different dating sites, which sold to IAC in 2009 for $80 million. Mm-hmm. And previously, Kelly was lead geek in the San Diego high-tech scene, where he co-founded both Red Door Interactive and DandyLife.com. Welcome, Kelly.
Hi.
Okay, before you say too much, let me welcome our co-host Nick Koster, who is the co-founder of BrainMates and is passionate about the benefits of putting the customer before the technology and building products and services that delight the buyer and the user. And BrainMates has been a co-host of the Global Product Management Talk from the beginning, helping us to develop and continuously iterate to create our passionate participants. So welcome, Nick.
Thank you, Cindy.
Shout out to John Newbery, who is a product manager from Leicestershire, United Kingdom. I think it's about midnight there. Welcome, John. And welcome, Robert Eaton and Aaron Managers from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome, Eunice, who is joining us in the room. Our questions can be found out at replies. They have been pre-posted. I will check to see if there are any pre-answers. And our first question is always to have people introduce themselves.
I was waiting for a question, so I guess I can just introduce myself and say hey to everyone. What a great world we live in, right? I'm in a town in southern New Mexico where there's 100 people within maybe 10 square miles. And I have broadband internet, and I can step outside the front door and get 4G connection, although I'm in a shadow where I am now, so I'm getting nothing. But still, fairly rural area in a very vast and open desert. Here we are talking to the rest of the world in real time. So how about that for love of products? I mean, it just doesn't get better than that.
It gives me shivers every now and then. I feel like we're living in the future.
Yeah. So by way of introduction, I think Cindy did a great thing. She listed all the bullet points, I guess, that I would put on a resume. You know, anywhere I go in, you know, people ask how we can help or what's our secret. You know, honestly, we kind of go into every project thinking, how can we fight for the user? And ultimately, you know, how do we give any company that we're working for, any product that we're developing, how do we turn it into something that in and of itself is a passion piece for the user, something that they're willing to talk about and sort of take on as something that's important to them in their life. I'd say fight for the users, and really when it comes to making a user passionate about a product, what you're doing is you're basically helping them be excellent in their own life. Not all products are appropriate for everybody. Certainly, I think a lot of product design is best when it's very focused and curtailed to fit the specific needs of a particular problem or use case. But when you're able to create successful users or users who are passionate about your product, what you're essentially doing is making them excellent at their own lives, whether it's some aspect of their work life or their home life or something that interests them, then you're in fact empowering them in some way. So that's where the passion comes from, when you can really get people to think of your product as being essential to their betterment. So Kathy Sierra is one of the original talkers about this idea of passion in user-based product development. And she talked about a broad range of subjects. When she gives her presentations, and some of those links have been provided prior to today's talk, when she talks about products, she's talking about not just the world that I live in, which is .com consumer internet, but the world we all live in, which is physical goods, consumer electronics, big box goods, small packaged goods. All these things are products that obviously product developers are, you know, key in developing. On the one hand, she might talk about digital cameras. On the other hand, she might talk about her saddle that she uses when she rides horses. And she'll talk about rock climbing and all these things as aspects of what's a good experience, what's a good product. One of the areas where she, I think, excels in her understanding of, or getting people to understand what it is that product developers can really do for users, it's getting them out of program mode. She uses this analogy. When you're using your camera, there's the P icon on your dial that means just do all the thinking for me. And it's a really easy out-of-box experience. You know, you start up the camera, you make sure it's charged, you turn it on, and you turn it to P, and you just start shooting photos, and you can enjoy it up to a certain level at that point. And then somehow the product needs to remind you, look, there's more to this thing than program mode. There's more than this thing that requires a little bit of learning, a little bit of effort on your part that will end up engendering so much more productivity and so much better experience with our product than just what P mode can do for you. She goes on to really describe how what that means is you create multiple layers or multiple resolutions of your product, meaning the deeper you go or the more refined your experience of the product goes, the more enjoyment or the more reward you might get. So when a layperson comes to a product, you need an open box experience. You need this fresh, tangible, easy to grasp product that just starts working right there in your hands. But as you become more expert in it, it needs to reward your investigation into that product. And there needs to be an extra level. You need to be able to level up and keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into the product to get more and more enjoyment, more reward out of it. And then, you know, obviously there's lots of tangible ways that that can be done. So anything that I'm talking about is all borrowed from her. It's sad that she's no longer blogging, but, you know, hopefully we can carry the torch for her.
Awesome. So Joan Newbery says that generating passion for the product within the organization is a positive indicator that it can do so in the market. And this is in response to the first question that we had posted, which was, how do you know if your brand or product is capable of inciting passion in users? To begin with, it might be a not exciting product.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've wrestled with this myself. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I develop is designed or built for consumers. So, you know, that's a lot different, clearly, an audience when, you know, for example, some companies work in B2B environment and maybe they're doing corporate sales and they're talking to a completely different unexcitable audience. You know, maybe they're lawyers or something, and their job is to be skeptical and analytical and I don't know, and not get excited about things. But I think there really is always a moment when you show what you're working on. The lean startup movement is, I think, onto a lot of this philosophy lately that's been arising in product development that allows people to think of doing cheap prototyping and cheap messaging and marketing to users to figure out whether or not what they're building is actually going to be viable in the marketplace. They use this term minimum viable product, MVP, and that's one way of thinking of it in the sense that you want to put the minimal amount of effort into developing something before you break the bank having developed something that nobody will use. And I think, honestly, I think one of the best things that any product development team can do is develop high-fidelity mockups. Show them to potential customers, maybe not even people that are existing customers, maybe people who you aren't trying to actively or hard sell to, but just people that you know are in the marketplace.
You said high fidelity?
Yeah, high fidelity, meaning to the naked eye, somebody could look over your shoulder at your computer and think that it was an actual live application.
Mm.
Right? I mean, so obviously that's going to be harder to do in the physical world. You could do 3D printing. And that's one way of developing a physical product that people can look and touch and critique and tell you whether it excites them or not. It's a little harder to do than what we do in the virtual world, but the high fidelity part of it is what I think is what tells that story. You can't really get people excited about wireframes or a business model or even a verbal story if it's not something that they feel like they can look and feel and touch. And so much of that passion indeed comes from the other senses. We take it for granted, but when you touch the object, when you hear the object, when it moves in front of you, those are things that actually in a way create a bond between you and the product in a way that nothing else can. So the higher fidelity, the more rendered it is, the better off you're going to be in testing that assumption. You know, unless you have billions of dollars and you're Steve Jobs and you can go into super R&D mode. But most of us are in this place where you can invest in high fidelity mockups, you can show people what your vision is virtually and get them to tell you what might be right or wrong with that vision, you know, to see if there's some excitement. But one of the things that they're going to say when they look at it, you know, you're onto something if they say, I got to have that. And you'll come across that. It's few and far between, but you'll come across that. The more iterations you do, you know, you learn after each session with a new user and you iterate and you improve on that mock-up. You improve on your idea. And eventually you'll get to that point where more and more people are telling you, I got to have that. I got to have that. That's really great. So
that's true. And there's a lot of agreement. For example, John Newbery says the only real way to know if your product will create passion is to launch it. And Nick says people either love it or hate it. Sometimes it's best if both are happening at the same time.
Yeah, I think love and hate are two sides of the same coin, right? I mean, that's a really valuable coin. If somebody hates your product so much, wow, that's passion, you know? I mean, there's nothing wrong with hate. I wouldn't be discouraged by that at all. And the more vehement the hate, I think the more you're onto something.
No.
You need to find those people who have a different philosophy because you're really touching a nerve there.
I guess when I was working with one of the first broadband ISPs in Australia, they had a website that started off almost as a hate site, and later on turned into a passionate user site where it became the de facto broadband forum from both media and ISPs alike.
Mm-hmm.
And what we saw there was, it was the site's called whirlpool.net, and when people go there, there's a user community who are passionate about broadband internet, wireless, fixed, DSL, cable, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become a de facto source of information that really was a runaway success, even though it's not heavily commercialized, because people were passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we saw there was that not only did people complain about it to get attention, but they started to help each other. It took a lot of the burden away from some of the support services that telcos were trying to develop anyway, because mm-hmm. they were already talking out of band.
Yeah, I think that by and large, that's pretty true. If you have a large or a dedicated or vehement and vocal following, these passionate users, then you're gonna see a lot of upside to that. There's downside to some of it, to the extent that you might have created a monster, right? This community of yours is now dictating where you can go with your product. So it takes strong product manager or strong CEO to corral them and lead them in a direction that the company indeed wants to go. Otherwise, you are at the mercy of your community. Or you can, play into that as much as possible and try and grow that audience. So it all depends on what your strategic direction is as a company and how your product can fall in line with that. That's one of the things that I love about product development is, obviously I come from a user-centric model. I think of the user and what their needs are. But as an entrepreneur, having sat on most of the other roles that are involved in the company, it's a fascinating position to be a product manager because, you have to talk to engineers and you have to talk to marketers and you have to talk to the account folks. And there's really no other position like it in the company. It takes a very unique talent set that can walk that delicate line between all the different stakeholders. And ultimately, you're the CEO of that product. So your success and failure is measured by how much that product is successful in the marketplace. So users, passionate users can help you help take you there.
One of the things I'm just trying to tweet is a photo that I took on the weekend of a physical, we were just talking about minimum viable prototypes or product mm-hmm. and physical prototypes. And this particular photo is of a set design made entirely out of cardboard. It's a copy of the set of the kitchen of the Two and a Half Men, the TV show, at an acting school. And what I thought was amazing was that out of just cardboard box, they've created a very realistic paper prototype of a 3D environment. While it's probably easier to create a sort of a web mock-up or a high-fidelity version of that, I think that we shouldn't limit ourselves to the online world in terms of creating those prototypes to find out what sparks people's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I can't share it with you because Twitter's making me passionate.
Clumis11, Karen Loomis, said, wasn't that Apple's philosophy? And also, Erin Manager says she's still here. That's a perfect description of the day in the life of a product manager. There's no role right for it.
I think she's talking about my comment about how the product manager is so uniquely positioned within the organization that their role just takes such a unique talent set.
Yes.
One of the things that I wanted to make sure that I at least talked about, this is another Kathy Sierra nod, was, kind of going back to this idea of, I think we talk about passionate users. I think it bears repeating what I mean when I talk about a passionate user and some of the telltale signs that you have a passionate user. So if I may, I'll just kind of describe that, a little bit here. One of the key factors in understanding understanding when you have a passionate user is when they talk about the product in terms of themselves in the first person. Here's an example. Like if I were to do a user study, right, and I sit down a user in front of, like a usability study, I put them in front of a product and I say, perform these actions and I watch them. And then I afterwards I have a little interview with them and I say, what did you like about the product? And they might give me some candid answers, and I'll say, what didn't you like about the product? And they'll give me more candid answers. One of the key things about passion is that when you say, what did you like, they're going to say things that surprise you in the sense that they're not describing the product. They're describing themselves. They'll say, I love it when I pull out my iPhone and I take a photo with Instagram and I can show somebody that photo and they go, how did you do that? And what are they talking about? Are they talking about the iPhone? Are they talking about Instagram? Are they talking about mobile phones? I mean, you know, what is the thing? But really what they're doing is they're saying, but that experience, that entire experience made me cooler. It made me more excellent. It made me happy. It's all about me, you know? And it doesn't matter what they're talking about. It doesn't matter that they're talking about Instagram or iPhones or whatever. They're talking about that experience and how it made them feel really good. And that's what you're after. That's what you're listening for. You know, that's the dog whistle that tells you whether you are on the passionate user base or not. Everything else is obviously stuff that you want to pay attention to and you want to address. And those are more of like the everyday boring technical details of making sure that your product functions and works in the marketplace the way it ought to. But you want to always listen for that first person narrative, that thing that says, even you might ask them a direct question, well, what did you think about this feature? And they'll go, I love it. It makes me feel alive. And it's like, whoa, that's not even a concrete answer. I can't do anything with that. But that's the kind of response you get when it's a passionate user who's looking at somehow making their life better by using your product. You know, conversely, the other thing is, terrible example because I don't want to disparage anything that AT&T is doing. It's a miracle that I'm here in rural New Mexico online doing what I do, and I got 4G on my AT&T service outside. Awesome, right? Love it, love it, love it. But I'm at home in San Diego, my internet goes down, and I just want to tear my high out and throw things against the wall, and I'm so angry because it's really something I can't live without. And I talk to my in-laws, the same thing. They're like, well, you know, when we go on vacation, I don't care if the television's not around. I need my internet. And they're really PO'd if they can't get access to it. And so that's what I'm talking about. It's a different side of the same coin. That passion comes from having such a good experience being online that they can't imagine their lives without being online. And so you might hear a negative in it, and AT&T might get discouraged by the fact that their customers are calling up PO'd that their internet went down, but at the same time, they have a really wonderful product that people can't live without. Mm. So that's what that means. It doesn't, you know, obviously they need to make improvements, but they've got something that people are passionate about.
So people rely upon it.
Yeah.
Well, people become passionate about the outcomes that it's delivering.
Yeah. I guess at the end of the day, my description of, you know, is it making you better? Is it making you more awesome? That's the result, right? That's the KPI for that user, is that somehow their ego got boosted by using this thing. It could be professionally or personally, but the end product for them was this result that made them more awesome, made them better at their job or better at life. And then, of course, you know, the talented product managers who are following along in this conversation, in concrete terms, obviously we know what that means, right? There's some tangible asset at the end of it as well. So I'll give you an example here. Here we are 30 minutes in, and it's the first time I'm going to mention Apple.
Been mentioned in the room, by the way.
Yeah, oh, yes, right. I did see them in the room. You know, Apple does a lot of things, right? Being one of the most valuable companies in the world, you're gonna turn to them for a lot of advice on things. So I don't feel ashamed by doing that. But one of the surprising things about Apple, I think, that surprises everybody in my life is that when we get done with a family trip or a birthday or something like that, we always print out one of those iBooks, those actual tangible photo books that come from iPhoto. And then, you know, we put them in a bookshelf, and there's a couple dozen in there by now. And sometimes, you know, we'll be having a dinner party, your friends will be over, and we'll pull out one of those books and say, you know, oh, here is our trip to France, right? And they look at it and they go, wow, you're a really good photographer, Kelly. I say, actually, I'm not. It's not me. It's just a really high quality book. You know, it's worth it to pay an extra $20 a book because look at it. It's beautiful. And obviously, you look at it and you think that I'm a great photographer, but I'm really not. It's just a really, really good quality book. But because I'm getting that feedback, me as the person who used the product, I'm getting the feedback from others that I'm good, that I'm better. And really, it's not me. It's the technology. It's the service that Apple provided. So now I can spread that word to, you know, all of my friends and say, you know, this is one of the reasons why I could never go to a PC, because I would never get this book in any other service. And it's you know, it's valuable enough in me and my life that I pay that extra $20 now to have this beautiful book that's going to be around forever. That's just kind of one of the examples of how that creates passion in me for a product because other people are telling me that it made me better. It validated that list.
And I think an interesting point you made there or commented there was that passion creates value. And value is something that companies or product managers can essentially charge more for. You're able to create that passion in your customers. They were willing to essentially pay more for a product that they could get a similar but, a less awesome feeling from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Karen Loomis asks, at what stage does marketing get involved to help hype the product both internally and externally?
Sure. So...
Which is a tactical issue, but speaking to hyping the passion or encouraging the passion around it.
Yeah. Internally, I firmly believe it's the product manager's job to be the evangelist, that the product manager needs to be as tuned in with the internal and external feedback that they're getting as possible. And the more that they're conversant, the more that they're social, both internally and external, the better. I'm going to skip from there and talk about marketing in the external sense, just because I think the whole internal thing is a job function more than a marketing function. Product marketing, I think, takes over on the external side more than on the internal side. That's my opinion. So product marketing and general marketing and, you know, sales and marketing, I think, really talk about filling the funnel, right? This is getting people from awareness to conversion to evangelism. And that's the complete life cycle, having skipped over many steps in between, but that's the complete life cycle for product marketers to pay attention to. Awareness, obviously, in a broader sense, marketing goes out and buys eyeballs and gets attention in the proper places and tells people about what your product and benefits are. Conversion is that real fine-tuned, you know, step-by-step, process-oriented, when we tell people this message, we're going to get this result aspect, and ultimately is focused on the sales process. So at the top of the funnel, you're making people aware. In the middle of the funnel where there's conversion, you're really trying to convince them to buy, right? And then once they buy, what you're looking for after that is evangelism, the thing where they're passionate enough about the product that they're going to tell other people about a product. The key there is looking at the Net Promoter Score, I think. It's a very valuable tool. If you don't know what it is, look it up. It's widely used. It's easy to learn, easy to implement. Very simple. It's a survey. You ask your users one question. You ask them a bunch of other questions that you want to find, you know, nuances on, but this one question is the Net Promoter Score, and that's the key to understanding whether you are onto something or not. And that's, would you share this product with somebody else? Or would you share this company with somebody else? Or would you share your knowledge or love of this product with somebody else? Basically, it's just saying, you know, how into it really are you? How into us are you? And then, you know, you'll see that grow or decline based on the passionate properties of your product. So product marketing really tries to, on the one sense, fill people in the funnel based on having discovered some unique product positioning to the product in the marketplace and knowing what values it can offer to people. And that comes from pains, you know, having pains and addressing those pains in the market. On the other hand, once you get past the purchase, you've converted and you want to get toward evangelism, what you're doing is you're arming your users, the people who use your product, you're arming them with the message that you want out at the top of the funnel again. So you tell them, you know, we're recycling here, but now we're using you to bring people into the top of the funnel. And what you have to be really clear about is that this needs to be a simple, really, really simple message. And
So essentially you're turning your users into your salespeople.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something that I've always felt, and we've talked about this a lot, that really everyone in the organization needs to be a salesperson in every touch point along the way of that product being developed and shipped is a sales transaction.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, let me give you an example of this, right? And this can really be something that the CEO is instrumental in creating. Outside or beyond the marketing team, beyond the product team, the CEO can establish a vision for the company. And that vision is ultimately what your customers are talking to their friends about when they own your product. And a good example here is there's a store in the U.S. called Container Store. What do they sell? Stuff you put other stuff in. Containers. I mean, it's probably the most boring business you could imagine. I mean, all it is boxes and, you know, stuff. It's just, it's mind-boggling. But you walk in, and from the very beginning, you understand that everybody there has a pride of customer service that's unparalleled. They want to help you find the right box. They are nuts about their boxes. And it's a vision that's set forth from the very top. They know that their product is customer service because what do? They sell this. They sell boxes. I mean, how much margin could there possibly be in that? But when you're thinking, I need to organize my closet, or I need to put some stuff away, or I need to get a storage unit or whatever, and you're like, all right, I need to go buy a bunch of boxes, that's the place you're going to go because you know you're going to find the right stuff there and somebody's going to help you find it. And they've invested so much along the entire process of the company establishing that vision of customer service that they've basically said there's not going to be anybody else ever in this space because we own it. We own the customer service in this space.
And they're very committed to, there's a lot of design thinking. So it's a really good experience when you walk in there. It's like you're walking into a magazine spread.
Yeah.
And the colors they use, it's bright, it's fun.
And you learn so much about storage. You're like, I didn't even know this stuff existed. <You know? laughs>
Well, I like boxes to begin with.
Turns out a lot of people do. A lot of people have a kind of anal retentive streak. But the point here is that now you know, I'm a customer of theirs, you're a customer of theirs. We're now spreading their vision message. It's not the product message, but it's the vision message, which ultimately is the product. Mm. And so the same thing with, that's where product evangelism, and that's why it's called evangelism, because it's, in a way, it's almost religious in their context. It's not concrete what people are talking about when they say, you got to use this. I could never, in a word, describe what it's like to be a Cleveland Indians fan. But when I meet another fan and we have that certain nod, you know what we're talking about. And it's just part of being a part of that community. And so that's established from your mission, vision, and values as a company altogether.
But I think, as you said, it's really fascinating when the product experience expands beyond the core product itself. And
yep.
Suddenly becomes a different product. So where the storage product, which was the core, becomes the experience product of the world of storage and customer support. And that's the differentiator that nobody can copy easily.
Yeah.
Whereas anyone can fill a box.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting, the brand, right, we're talking about brand here now, right? We've expanded from product to brand. And there's a really interesting anecdote from I just forgot his name. He's the ex-CEO of GE who wrote the book on being a big-time CEO. Anyway, the story's not about him. It's about something he discovered while working at GE, that you can't have a bad experience in any one of the products of a company, or you can't have something that parts way with that mission, vision, and values. And the example that he gave was he's trying to sell jet engines to Boeing. And one of the Boeing engineers is like, I have this crappy GE toaster. What do I want a jet engine from you guys for? And it doesn't matter that they're different product teams, different engineers, just in everything, right? They're separate, almost separate entire companies. They may as well not even have the brand GE on it. But they did have the brand GE on it. And because one company wasn't upholding that mission, vision, value with the product, it ended up costing the deal on the other part of the company. That's where what you're doing in your product, really, that's where you need to figure out how it's benefiting the company as a whole and how it speaks the brand that you're trying to create, the company that you're trying to create.
Mm. I guess, Kelly, I'd have to disagree a little bit there that it becomes all about the brand, because maybe I'm a bit too product management-centric, but I see the brand operates really as shorthand for the core product as well as that product experience. That kind of, in the same example you just used there, that when the product let down the brand or didn't support the other products around it, it wasn't the brand that changed, it was the product experience. So the brand is simply a short form, sort of a shortcut way of describing the entire experience that the customer has with the products at every level. And is only as good as the last experience that people had with the products that the company is selling. I think what's really interesting, and again, you touched on it earlier, we're talking about the design of products and the actual design of the end-to-end experience from the very first moment that someone hears about a product, from the sales messaging to the sales process to the marketing to the walking in the front door of the shop to the buying process of the product, all of those things represent both success and failure points for a product experience. As you mentioned, the example of the storage container store, mm-hmm. Every step that was described there had been designed out. That's where, and I think that's really where brands and organizations can differentiate themselves these days in very commoditized environments.
Yeah, in commoditized environments. What about, we were just talking about GE too. What was your critique of my interpretation of how the brand was negatively impacted?
My critique was talking mainly about the fact that the brand is the strong point. I guess I only see brands as being a shorthand form of the last positive or negative experience I had with a product. The brand itself is nothing but a label that represents that experience. So as you said with your G experience, the fact that the same shorthand for, you know, the same brand was on both a jet engine and a toaster,
mm-hmm.
meant that shorthand was only as good as the experience I had with the toaster.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that my concern is that sometimes we get over-focused on managing the brand as though it's separate from the product, and I don't believe it is. I believe that the brand is absolutely embodied by the product experience
yeah.
that people have.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and what you're saying about the first or last experience that you've had with that product is actually very important too. People really, it's the primacy and recency stuff in psychology, right? You remember first and last experiences so much more than you remember anything in between.
Do you want to jump to the effect of isolation on a product and what you meant by that? There were a few previous questions about when do users need or want a community along with the product? And how do companies learn to incorporate community into their product strategy?
I think that unless you're selling arms, right, you pretty much want all of your customers to talk with each other. There's a key lesson in the book Crossing the Chasm about knowing who your market is, and it's this idea of a self-referencing market. It's something in the product world I think we don't pay enough attention to, which is when you develop a market in a way you almost are developing a specific type of user or a specific type of customer who can be more widely applicable across 100 or thousands of different companies, right? Sorry, that's in a B2B environment. In a B2C environment, you know that there's a self-referencing thing. It's like self-referencing means if I'm a photographer, I know that there's a word for it, for one. I know that I can go talk to other photographers and say, well, you know, how do I solve this problem? Or what would you use in this situation? And they'll tell me, they'll give advice. That's self-referencing, and that's part of the marketing component of product development. So in isolation, what we risk is, A, having not really clearly identified what that self-referencing market is. You create a market, you create a product that solves problems, but it solves problems so horizontally, meaning across a bunch of different sectors, that those people are never likely to talk to one another and never likely to spread the word about how good your product is. So that's what you risk when you develop in isolation on the marketing side. As far as, and I think this is probably a lesson that you guys have all talked about in prior discussions, when you develop in isolation without users giving you feedback, you're also running risk there. You can have a very visionary product manager, you can have a very visionary CEO and designer and engineers who are building this really wonderful, wonderful, wonderful product. But I think at every step along the way, you need to validate with users whether or not it's something that they find valuable or not, or whether or not they had that aha or I gotta have it moment. And that's what we risk by working in isolation.
Okay, so that is a very interesting point where you're talking about the product needs to reference the market. And something about the narrative around the product. It needs to be a narrative that people can relate to or that already exists in the market.
Yeah, I think, you know, narrative is really important because, you know, the product marketing people and the evangelists and stuff like that, they want a story that they need to tell other people. And, you know, we'll just use cameras because I'm a camera guy and, you know, Kathy Sierra is a camera girl and we're all camera people. I mean, right? Everybody loves cameras. They love pictures. So I have this little adapter on my SLR for my Canon that allows me to take lenses from other types of cameras and put them on my Canon. And I absolutely love the fact that it's this little $5 adapter and I can go and I can buy 30 or 40 different adapters. So now I can go into an old, you know, photo store and buy an old piece of glass that's just sitting on the shelf and collecting dust and would cost $20 now because nobody likes these cameras anymore. They like the digital ones. And so that's a story I can tell, right? Some other photographer comes up and says, how did you get that Vivitar lens on your Canon camera? Now I can tell the story. right? And then they're going to go on eBay and they're going to find that adapter and they're going to do it themselves. Narrative is such a key component, and Seth Godin talks about this in his books. Narrative is such a key component of that self-referencing market and how word gets out about how great your product is and what, you know, how it can make people's lives better. He takes an example in his book. I forget the name of the book. There's so many of them. Where there's this wine glass by a company called Riedel, stemless wine glasses. And they've got this whole elaborate story about how their glass is so refined and so well made and how the taste, you know, the wine tastes so much better when it's coming out of the glass. Well, when they do, you know, blind taste tests, nobody can tell the difference. But of course, it's this iconic looking glass. And there's a story that goes along with it when people say, oh, that's a cool looking glass. You say, oh, it's Riedel and it does all this stuff and it's made from the world's finest glass and da 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 da. And it makes your wine taste so good. And that's just like the capper. That's like the last bit that almost wouldn't even matter. You don't even need to say the wine tastes better with the glass because there was this huge story that went into creating interest in it, in the product anyway. So in a way, it's all that story that's creating value in the product. And why they can charge $20 a glass as opposed to, you know, what you're going to get at IKEA. And that's also, you know, one of the key reasons. I mean, one of the questions I put up there is why is community, or how do you need community? Why would any product need community? I think that's exactly it. You're leaving an opportunity on the table when your customers themselves are not talking to your other potential customers. The best way to engender trust in your potential customers. It's the best way to build awareness in your potential customers. Every study that's ever been done about conversion and market research suggests that when you have an unsolicited support for a product from somebody else, then you're going to just start to see your sales go through the roof. So community is essential to that. Product people are passionate about is the way that community gets built, in my opinion.
Excellent. Kamal Dahir says, customers can be your most effective sales force. They generate loyalty and advocacy. All successful products show it.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen had said, agree, a brand is all-encompassing, all products and services. Consumers aren't astute enough to understand the difference between brand lines.
Okay. Yeah.
I actually think it's a little bit more basic than that. They actually don't care. Brand lines are something we create. The customers don't care about brand lines. That's our problem.
Yeah.
Kind of the astuteness is something that we might be trying to create, but it's not their job to care about whether a GE toaster is the same quality as a GE gen engine.
Yeah.
Okay, so customers may not care about brand lines, only their experience of quality?
I think it's when we try and create brand lines as saying, if you like this product, then you should like this other product. And if we expect people to not understand that, then it's really product management's fault if they don't. I've seen one great website with 25 brand extensions that were terrible failures because the organizations that created them thought that they were great extensions for their products, but of course, in hindsight, they were ridiculous because no one saw the link between them.
Mm-hmm.
Like a fragrance for Harley Davidson.
Exactly. How much is vision a part of creating products consumers are passionate about? I think you actually spoke to that earlier, Kelly,
about
the CEO's vision. And how much is feedback a part of creating products? So we've basically incorporated these questions in the conversation, but maybe not specifically. So do you want to speak to feedback?
Yeah, well, I have a good story I think that would be good for, you know, wrapping up. I'm of the generation, I'm 37 years old tomorrow. Happy birthday to me.
Oh, happy birthday, Kelly.
Thank you. I'm of the generation where we were the first kids to really use and feel wonderful about Walkmans. I had a Walkman when I was 8 or 9 years old, and the next thing that I got from Sony, because Sony invented the Walkman, was a dual cassette deck, and I started making my own mixtapes. And Nick, you just laughed, right? Because we're contemporaries in that respect. And there's this thing that our love of Sony, I think, goes directly back to that. I can't speak for you, but I can speak for me. And I love Sony because I remember holding that Walkman and I remember making those mixtapes. And God, I was passionate about it. I mean, it was such a cool product experience, unlike anything before that. How many years later? You know, this is 30 years, going on 30 years later, and I still love Sony. Even though they haven't made a product that I've actually purchased in 15 or 20 years, right? I mean, I think the last thing I bought from them was a Discman. And they've been riding that pony for a long time. And its passion is invaluable. It's invaluable. Once you create that connection with the consumer, man, you got it. You got it. So I hope they can do it again soon.
Yeah. I went down the Discman path, then the memory stick path, and I lost the passion.
Mm-hmm. But you still have that fondness for the brand.
I do.
Yeah.
I have hope.
Yeah. So that's that. That's my end there.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Thank you to our speaker, Kelly Abbott, and our co-host, Nick Koster, for discussing creating passionate users. We definitely touched all the major points and certainly exposed a wider audience to Kathy Sierra, who may be well-known, less well-known in product management circles than in developer circles. Thank you also for, you mentioned during our discussion quite a few examples of specific brands and products, and I will try and capture those from the podcast. And thank you to our participants. John Newberry says, some businesses don't enable customer interaction because they're scared of what they or prospects may hear. I want to, again, thank our sponsor, the Association of International Product Management and Marketing, and encourage you to join the webinar this Friday on becoming an industry standard certified product manager. If you go to our website at PRODMGMTTALK, we have a vast amount of information. And coming up next week is Pinkus Shah, who is the CEO of Adaptive Marketing in India. We'll be discussing the business case for setting up product management teams in India and China. So really speaking to our global and international audience.
Hey, before we sign off, I want to answer John's question about his comment about businesses not enabling customer interaction because they're scared of what their prospects might hear.
Great.
And to that, I would say the same thing that I would say to any entrepreneur who wants to give me an NDA before looking at their idea. And that's absolutely nobody is going to create awesome better than you are. You know, it's impossible for a company to compete with you on awesomeness. And if you don't believe that, and if you're not developing for awesomeness, that's fine. You can do that. But if you're developing for awesomeness, there's nothing to fear because the competition can't replicate awesomeness the way that you're going to do it. It's that intangible certain something that's your brand promise. That's the thing that your company does better than anybody else. Otherwise, you wouldn't exist.
Ah, okay. And so are you familiar with John Green, who talks about awesomeness?
UCBA is an initialism, not an acronym.
Right. For
don't forget to be awesome.
Don't forget to be awesome.
Yeah, I
think there's a whole community of nerd fighters, they're called, and that is their mission statement. Don't forget to be awesome.
Oh, I've heard about this. Yeah, okay, I'm going to go look it up now.
Blog Brothers. They're nerd fighters from BLOG Brothers, and they do, talk about an awesome community. They do YouTube videos. They have this community of people who... well, I live with one who everything has to stop when they post a new video.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Probably a great point there. In fact, I just heard about these guys. I know, silly that they've had like a billion page views by now, but I've just heard of them.
We're not necessarily their demographic.
Yeah. I think it's teenagers mostly, right? Bread and butter.
But I'll tell you, I did go to an event where they did a book signing, and I was amazed at the diversity of age, gender, and everything else, of people that were waiting for hours to get in the door. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks
for joining us amidst everything else that you have going on in your life, in your awesomeness, in your family.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick, for joining us. And bearing with our time changes, which I think we might have changed the time about three times during the past week.
Yep, or 24 hours.
Yes, and heads up, I don't know what the time will be for next week because we will try and coordinate with India.
Okay.
include our counterparts there. This is Cindy F. Solomon signing off for this week's Global Product Management Talk. Thank you, everyone who joined in.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Cindy.
Okay.
Thanks, Kelly.
You're welcome, Nick. Bye-bye.
Bye.